right to share this with the others. On that day, she would lead them to the boat and show them what she had discovered. But not just yet. For now, like her journals and the story they told, it would be her secret, this message from the past, engraved upon the transom of a derelict lifeboat. Bergensfjord, Oslo, Norway. 88. Carter held his breath as long as he could. Bubbles rose around his face. His lungs were screaming for air. The world above seemed miles away, though in fact it was only a few feet. Finally, he could endure it no longer. He pushed off and zoomed to the surface, exploding into the summer sunshine. "Do it again, Anthony!" Haley was clinging to his back. She was wearing a pink two-piece suit and cobalt blue goggles that made her look like an enormous bug. "All right," he laughed. "Just give me a second. Besides, it's Riley's turn." Haley's sister was sitting on the pool deck, dangling her feet in the water. Her bathing suit was one piece, green, with a flouncy skirt and a single plastic daisy appliqued onto one shoulder strap. She was wearing orange water wings. Carter could toss her into the water for hours without her getting bored. "Again, again!" demanded Haley. Rachel walked toward them from the garden. She was dressed in shorts and a white t-shirt streaked with dirt. On her head, a broad straw hat. In one gloved hand, she held a pair of shears. In the other, a basket of freshly cut flowers of various types and colors. "Girls, let Anthony catch his breath." "I don't mind," Carter said. He was clinging to the side. "It's no bother."
"See," said Haley. "He says he doesn't mind."
"That's because he's being polite." Rachel removed her gloves and dropped them into the basket. Her face shone with sweat and sun. "How about some lunch?"
"What do we have?" Haley asked.
"Let me think." Her mother frowned theatrically.
"Hot dogs?"
"Yay! Hot dogs!"
Rachel broke into a smile.
"I guess that decides it.
Hot dogs it shall be. Do you want one, Anthony?" He nodded.
"I can always take a hot dog."
She returned to the house. Carter climbed from the pool and got towels for himself and the girls.
"Can we swim more?"
Haley asked as he was rubbing her hair. It was blonde, with flecks of a copper color. Riley's was a soft, heathery brown, quite long. She liked to wear it in pigtails when she swam.
"Depends on what your mama says. Maybe after lunch."
She made her eyes grow wide. That was the kind of girl she was, always putting on a show to get what she wanted. It was the funniest thing.
"If you say yes, she'll have to say it too."
"Don't work that way, you know that.
We'll just have to see." He squeezed the last of the water from her hair, sent the two of them off to play, and sat at the wrought iron table to catch his breath and watch. There were toys all over the yard. Barbies, stuffed animals, a brightly colored plastic playset Haley was too big for but still liked to fool with, the two of them pretending it was other things, such as the counter at a store. Haley had gone off in one direction, her sister in another.
"Look!" Riley yelled. "I found a toad."
She was crouched over the path by the garden gate.
"Is that right?" Carter said. "You go on and bring that over here and let me have a look."
She walked to the patio with cupped palms extended before her, her big sister following.
"Now that there is one handsome toad," Carter declared.
The creature, a mottled tan color, was breathing rapidly, loose skin flapping along its sides.
"I think it's disgusting," Haley said with a sour face. "Can I keep him?" Riley asked. "I want to name him Pedro."
"Pedro," Carter repeated with a slow nod.
"Sounds like a fine name."
"Now, of course," he went on, "he may already got one. That's something to consider. Something he goes by with the other toads."
The little girl's face pinched with a frown.
"But toads don't have names." "Now how you know?
Do you speak Toad?
That's silly, the older girl stated. She was tugging at the bottom of her suit. Don't listen to him, Riley.
Carter leaned forward in his chair and raised a finger, drawing their attention to his face.
I'm going to tell you something true now, both of you, he said. And that is this. Everything got a name. It's got a way to know itself. That's an important lesson in life.
The smaller girl stared at him. Trees?
Sure, he replied.
Flowers?
Trees, flowers, animals, everything living.
Haley looked at him askance. You're making this up.
Carter smiled.
Not in the least. Grown folks know things, you'll see.
I still want to keep him, Riley insisted.
Maybe so. And I'm sure Mr. Toad would like that just fine. But a toad belongs in the grass with the other toads who know him. Plus, your mama would pitch a fit she knew I let you keep him.
I told you, Haley moaned.
Carter sat back.
You two go on now. You can play with him a bit if you like, but leave him be after that.
They scampered away. Carter rose to put on his shirt and sat back down. The sun was mild on his face in the dappled shade of the live oaks. From far away, he heard a quiet wash of traffic. A few minutes passed before Rachel came out the back door, bearing a tray of the promised hot dogs. Riley's had ketchup and cheese, Haley's mustard. Carter's had all three. For herself, Rachel had made a salad. She returned to the kitchen and came back out with paper plates and a bag of chips, then once more with drinks. Milk for the girls, a pitcher of tea for the grown-ups.
Riley found a toad, Carter remarked. Wanted to keep it as a pet.
Rachel put the hot dogs onto plates and laid out napkins.
Of course she did.
I'm assuming you said no.
She looked up and raised her voice.
Girls, come for lunch.
They ate their hot dogs and chips and drank their tea and milk. Afterward, cherry popsicles for dessert. By the time they finished, the girls were starting to fade. Usually Riley took a nap after lunch. Haley would put up a fuss, but wasn't too old for one, especially after the morning they'd had, hours and hours of playing in the pool in the hot sun. With promises of more swimming later, they ushered the girls into the house, Carter carrying Riley, who was already half asleep. In the girls' bedroom, he passed her off to Rachel, who removed Riley's damp suit, replaced it with a t-shirt and underpants, and tucked her into bed. Haley was already under the covers.
Now I want you two to sleep, Rachel said from the door. No fooling around.
She closed the door with a quiet click.
Come to think of it, she said, I could go for a nap myself.
Carter nodded. I was thinking the same thing. Girls just about wore me out.
In the bedroom, he traded his bathing suit for an old pair of shorts he liked, soft from laundering, and lay down on top of the comforter. Rachel moved in beside him. He put his arm around her and pulled her close. Her hair had a clean, sweet smell he loved. It was just about the nicest thing there was.
You know, she said softly, I was thinking.
What's that now?
She shrugged against his chest.
Just how wonderful this morning was. The garden was so beautiful.
Carter pulled her tighter against him to say he thought the same.
I could do this forever, she said.
Forever was what they had. Soon her breathing steadied, long and low, like waves upon a placid shore. Its rhythm moved into him in a soft current, taking him with her. What happiness, thought Carter, and closed his eyes. What happiness at last.
14. The Garden by the Sea, 343 AV. This bud of love, by summer's ripening breath, may prove a beauteous flower when next we meet. Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. 89. She had chosen a spot in sight of the river. The earth was softer here, but that was not the only reason. As dawn broke over the ridgeline, Amy began to dig. The river was low, as it always was in summer. Mist floated atop the water like smoke. She dug first to the calls of birds, then, as the heat built, to the stillness spreading over the land. Stopping now and then to rest, she finished at midday. At the river's edge, she splashed her face and cupped her palms to drink. She was sweating profusely in the heat. For a time, she sat on a rock to gather herself, her shovel resting above her on the bank. In the shallows, she detected the shapes of trout tucked behind rocks. Protected from the current, they held themselves in place with small flicks of their tails, lying in wait for the insects that washed downstream to their open mouths. The body was swathed in a sheet. Amy used a wooden bier and ropes, tackled to a sturdy tree limb to lower it. Her thoughts were ordered and calm. She'd had years to prepare for this moment. But at the first pattering of soil upon the shroud, she experienced a rush of emotion, an upwelling of feelings she had no name for. It seemed like many things at once. It came not from her mind, but from a deeper place, almost physical. Tears mixed with the perspiration streaming down her face. One shovelful at a time, the body disappeared, becoming one with the earth. She tamped the surface and knelt by the grave. She would erect no marker. The proper memorial would be made in due course. Perhaps an hour passed. She possessed no sense of time, nor had the need to. Her heart felt heavy and full. As the sun touched the line of the hills, she pressed one palm to the freshly turned earth. "Goodbye, my love," she said. Peter had died, as he had long believed he would, on a summer afternoon. 4 nights ago, he had failed to return to the house. This had happened before, when his wanderings took him too far to make it back before first light. But when he didn't appear the next night, Amy went to look for him. She found him curled beneath an overhang on the east side of the mesa, his body wedged tightly against the rocks. He was only partially conscious. His breathing was quick and thin, his skin pallid, his hands dry and cold. She wrapped him in a blanket and lifted him into her arms. The lightness of his body shocked her. She carried him back to the house and upstairs to the bedroom. She had already closed the shutters. She laid him in the bed and got in next to him, holding him as he slept. And the next morning, she sensed something. A presence. Death had entered the house. He seemed to experience no pain, just a kind of fading. He did not regain awareness of his surroundings, or did not seem to. The hours passed. She would not leave him, not for a moment. At midday, his breathing slowed until it was barely perceptible. Amy waited. A moment came when she realized he had slipped away. Now, her task complete, she returned to the house and made a simple dinner for herself. She tidied the kitchen and put her dishes away. The quiet of eternity had settled over the rooms. Darkness came on. The stars wheeled above the silent land. She had preparations to make, but these could wait until morning. She did not want to go upstairs. Those days were over. She bedded down on the sofa, curled beneath a blanket, and soon was fast asleep. Dawn's soft glow in the windows awakened her. Standing on the porch, she took measure of the day, then returned to the house to prepare her supplies. She had fashioned a simple pack with a wooden frame she could carry on her back. Into this went the things for her journey: a blanket,
some simple tools, extra clothing, food for a couple of days, a plate and cup, a tarp, a coil of rope, a sharp knife, bottles of water. That which she lacked or had failed to anticipate, she could find along the way. Upstairs, she washed and dressed. In the mirror above the stand, she saw her face. She, too, had aged. She might have been a woman of 40, perhaps 45. Ribbons of gray, almost white, threaded through her long hair. Crinkles fanned from the corners of her eyes. Her lips had thinned and paled, becoming almost colorless. How much time would go by before this face, her face, was observed by another living soul? Would this even happen? Or would she pass from the world unseen? In the living room, Amy sat at the piano. Its existence was nothing she'd ever been able to account for. When she and Peter had arrived at the farmstead all those years ago, the piano was waiting, a gift from beyond. Every night, Amy played it. The music was the force that summoned Peter home. Now, placing her hands above the keys, she waited for something to come to her. With a quiet chord, she began, letting her hands tell her where to go. Bright notes filled the house. Within the song's phrases lay all that she felt. It passed through her in waves, rising and falling, circling and returning, a language of pure emotion. "I never grow tired of it," Peter always told her. He would stand behind her, placing his hands on her shoulders with the gentlest touch to feel the music as she did, as a force that flowed from within. "I could listen to you play forever, Amy." "Every song is a love song," she thought. "Every song is for you." She came to the end. Her hands stilled above the keys. The last notes hovered, faded, and were gone. So, the moment of parting. A lump had lodged in her throat. She cast her eyes a final time about the room. It was just a room, like any other. Simple furnishings, a hearth blackened with long use, candles on the tables, books. But it meant vastly more. It meant everything. Here they had lived. She rose, put on her pack, and strode out the door, not looking back. She reached California in the fall. First the deserts, scorched by the sun, then mountains emerged from the haze, their great blue backs surging above the arid valley. 2 more days in sight of them, and she began to climb. The temperature declined. Cool green woodlands waited at the top. Beneath her, the valleys and mountains of the High Mojave undulated in the haze. The wind was fierce and dry on her face. At length, the colony wall appeared. It was still towering in places, in others crumbled to ruin, barriers of vegetation poking through the rubble. Amy scrambled over the detritus and made her way to the center of town. Great trees stood where none had grown before. Most of the buildings were gone, collapsed into their foundations. Yet a handful of the larger ones remained. She came to the structure that had been known as the sanctuary. The roof had caved in. The building was a shell. She mounted the steps to look through a window that had miraculously remained unbroken. It was caked with grime. She used a dampened cloth to make a small porthole and cupped her eyes to the glass. Open to the sky, the interior had become a forest. It took her some time to get her bearings, but eventually she located the stone. It had settled into the earth somewhat. Many of the names inscribed into its face had washed away to mere depressions, scarcely legible. Still, she was able to discern certain surnames. Fisher, Wilson, Donadio, Jackson. Evening was approaching. She removed her pack and withdrew her tools.
chisels and gouges of various sizes, picks and two hammers, one large, one small. For a time, she sat on the ground, surveying the stone. Her eyes traveled over the stoic surface as she planned her attack. She could have waited until morning, but the moment seemed right. She selected a spot, took up her chisel and hammer, and began. She finished on the morning of the third day. Her hands were bloody and raw. The sun was high in the sky as she stood back to examine her handiwork. The quality of the inscription was unpracticed, but on the whole, better than she'd hoped. She slept that day and all the next night, and in the morning, refreshed, packed her camp and descended the mountain. She headed west, first away from the sun and then toward it. The land was empty, without history, devoid of life. The days passed in wind-swept silence, until one morning, Amy heard the sea. On the air was the scent of flowers. The sound, a low roaring, expanded. Suddenly, the Pacific appeared. Its blue expanse seemed infinite. She felt as if she were beholding an entire planet. White-tipped waves crashed upon the shore. She made her way through banks of wild roses and eelgrass down to the wide beach at the water's edge. She felt uneasy, but also consumed by a sudden urge. She stripped off her pack and then her clothes and sandals. As the first wave broke across her body, its power nearly knocked her off her feet. A second claimed her, and rather than resist, she dove down into the surging water. She could no longer touch the bottom. It had happened that fast. She experienced no fear, only a wild, startled joy. It was as if she had rediscovered a wholly natural condition in which she was connected to the forces of creation. The water was wonderfully cold and salty. With the barest motions of her arms and legs, she could keep herself afloat. She allowed herself to bob freely in the swells, then dove down again. Beneath the surface, she opened her eyes, but could see virtually nothing, just vague shapes. She rolled her body to look up. Brilliant sunshine ricocheted off the face of the water, making a kind of halo. Gazing at this heavenly light, she held her breath as long as she could, hidden in this unseen world beneath the waves. She decided to remain a while. Every morning she swam, each time moving farther out. She was not testing her resolve. Rather, she was waiting for a new impulse to emerge. Her body felt clean and strong, her mind rinsed of all care. She was entering a new phase of life. She spent her days just sitting and watching the waves, or taking long walks up and down the sandy expanse. Her needs were simple and few. She discovered a grove of oranges, and near that, great banks of blackberries. And these were what she ate. She missed Peter, but the feeling was not the same as missing something she had lost. He was gone, but would always be a part of her. Content as she was, she realized over the months that her journey had not ended. The beach was a way station, a place of preparation for the final leg. When spring came, she broke camp and made her way north. She had no destination in mind. She would let the land speak to her. The terrain grew more rugged. Rocky promontories, the heart-stopping beauty of the California coast, towering trees blasted by the salted winds into strange, grasping shapes that cantilevered over the sea. She passed her days walking, the sun's hands pressing on her shoulders, the ocean beside her, curling and falling. At night, she bedded down beneath the stars, or if it was raining, a tarp suspended on a cord between the limbs of a tree. She saw animals of every type, the small ones, squirrels and rabbits and groundhogs, but also larger, statelier creatures, antelope and bobcats and even bears, great dark shapes shambling through the brush. she was alone on a continent that man had conquered and then left. Soon, no trace of his long habitation would remain. It would all be new again. Spring became summer, summer fall. The days were crisp and cool, and at night she built a fire for warmth. She was north of San Francisco. She didn't know quite where. One morning she awoke under her tarp and knew at once that something had changed. She emerged into a world of soft white light and silence. Snow had fallen in the night. Fat flakes floated soundlessly down from the sky. She tipped her face upward, receiving them. Flakes clung to her lashes and hair. She opened her mouth to taste them on her tongue. A flood of memories engulfed her. It was as if she were a girl again. She lay on her back and extended her legs and arms, moving them back and forth to carve a shape in the snow. A snow angel. She understood, then, the nature of the force that was drawing her north. She did not arrive until spring, and even then was caught by surprise. It was early morning, the forest air thick with mist. The sea, far below, at the base of a tall cliff, was heavy and dark. In the dense shade of trees, she was cresting a rise when all of a sudden, a feeling of completeness overwhelmed her, so arresting that it froze her in her tracks. She ascended the rest of the way and emerged into a clearing with a view of the ocean. And there, her heart seemed to stop. The field was carpeted with the most lustrous show of wildflowers she had ever seen. Flowers by the hundreds, the thousands, the millions. Purple irises, white lilies, pink daisies, yellow buttercups and red columbines and many others she knew no names for. A breeze had arisen. The sun had broken through the clouds. She shrugged off her pack and walked slowly forward. It was as if she were wading into a sea of pure color. The tips of her fingers brushed the petals of the flowers as she passed. They seemed to bow their heads in salutation, welcoming her into their embrace. In a trance of beauty, Amy moved among them. Corridors of golden sunshine fell over the field. Far away, across the sea, a new age had begun. Here, she would make her garden. She would make her garden and wait. Epilogue, The Millennialist. Indo-Australian Republic, population 186 million, 1003 AV. The past is never dead. It's not even past. William Faulkner, Requiem for a Nun. 90. Third Global Conference on the North American Quarantine Period, Center for the Study of Human Cultures and Conflicts, University of New South Wales, Indo-Australian Republic, April 16th through 21st, 1003 AV. Transcript, Plenary Session 1. Welcoming Address by Dr. Logan Miles, Professor and Chair of Millennial Studies, University of New South Wales, and Director of the Chancellor's Task Force on North American Research and Reclamation. Good morning and welcome, everyone. I'm happy to see so many esteemed colleagues and valued friends in the audience today. We have a busy schedule, and I know everyone is eager to get started with the presentations, so I will keep these opening remarks brief. This gathering, our third, brings together researchers from every settled territory, in virtually every field of study. Among our numbers, we count scholars in disciplines as various as human anthropology, systems theory, biostatistics, environmental engineering, epidemiology, mathematics, economics, folklore, religious studies, philosophy, and on and on. We are a diverse group, with a range of methodologies and interests. But we are united by a common purpose, one that runs far deeper than any specific field of study. It is my hope that this conference will serve not only as a springboard for innovative scholarly collaboration,
but also as an occasion for reflection, the opportunity for all of us, individually and collectively, to consider the broader, humanistic questions that lie at the heart of the North American quarantine and its history. This is especially important now as we pass the millennial mark and the project of North American reclamation under the authority of the Trans-Pacific Council and the Brisbane Accord moves into its second phase. A millennium ago, human history very nearly came to an end. The viral pandemic we know as the Great Catastrophe killed over 7 billion people and brought humanity to the edge of extinction. Some among us would assert that this event was an arbitrary occurrence, nature's way of shuffling the deck. Every species, no matter how successful, eventually encounters a force greater than itself, and it was simply our turn. Others have postulated that the wound was self-inflicted, the consequence of mankind's rapacious assault upon the very biological systems that sustained our existence. We made war on the planet, and the planet fought back. Yet there are many, and I count myself among them, who look at the history of the Great Catastrophe and see not merely a tale of suffering and loss, arrogance and death, but also one of hope and rebirth. How and where the virus originated is a door that science has yet to unlock. Where did it come from? Why did it vanish from the earth? Is it still out there waiting? We may never know the answers, and in the last instance, I pray we never do. What is known is that our species, against the greatest odds, endured. On an isolated island in the South Pacific, a pocket of humanity survived, eventually to spread the seeds of a reborn civilization across the southern hemisphere and establish a second age of humankind. It has been a long struggle, fraught with peril, and we have far to go. History teaches us that there are no guarantees, and we ignore the lessons of the Great Catastrophe at our peril. But the example of our forebears is no less instructive. Our instinct for survival is indomitable. We are a species of unconquerable will and the capacity for hope. And should that day come again when the forces of nature rise up against us, humanity will not go quietly. Until very recently, very little of substance was known about our ancestors. Scripture tells us that they made their passage to the South Pacific from North America, and that they carried with them a warning. North America, it was said, was a land of monsters. To return was to bring death and ruin down upon the world once more. Until 1,000 years had passed, no man or woman should set foot there. This injunction has been a central tenet of our civilization, encoded as law by virtually every civic and religious institution since the foundation of the Republic. No scientific evidence has heretofore existed to support this claim, or even its source. We have, so to speak, taken the matter on faith, but it lies at the core of who we are. Much has changed in the last few years. With the discovery of the ancient writings we know as the Book of Twelves, new light has been shed on the past. Concealed in a cave on the southernmost of the Holy Isles, this text of unknown authorship has for the first time lent historical credence to our common lore, even as it has deepened the mysteries of our origins. Dating from the 2nd century AV, the Book of Twelves recounts an epic contest on the North American continent between a small band of survivors and a race of beings called Virals. At the center of this struggle is the young girl Amy, the girl from nowhere. Possessing unique powers of body and spirit, she leads her fellows, Peter, the man of days, Alicia of blades, Michael the clever, Sarah the healer, Lucius the faithful et al., in the fight to save humanity. The tale and its cast of characters are familiar to all, of course. No document in our history has been the subject of as much study, speculation, and in many cases outright skepticism as this manuscript. Certainly, elements of the narrative are far-fetched, more the province of religion than science. Yet from the moment of its discovery, nearly everyone has agreed that it is a document of extraordinary importance, that it should be found in the Holy Isles, the cradle of our civilization, forges the first tangible link between North America and the lore that has shaped and guided us for nearly a millennium. I am a historian. I deal in facts, in evidence. My professional creed dictates that only through the prisms of doubt and patient scholarship can the truth of the past be revealed. But one thing my various travels in the past have taught me, ladies and gentlemen, is that behind every legend lies an element of truth. May I have the first slide, please? Since our return to North America 36 months ago, a great deal has been learned about the state of the continent both before and during the quarantine period. These two images represent two very different North Americas. The contrast could not be more vivid. On the top, we see a reconstruction of the continent as it stood in the final years of the American imperial period. Cities of millions dominated both coasts. Unsustainable agricultural practices had decimated virtually all of the continent's interior plains. Heavy industry, powered by fossil fuels, had rendered vast swaths of land virtually uninhabitable, the soil and water fouled by heavy metals and chemical byproducts. Though some wilderness remained, primarily in the alpine regions of the Appalachian Uplift, the northern Pacific coast, and the Intermountain West, there is little doubt that the image represents a continent and a culture consuming itself. On the bottom, we see North America as it now stands. Airship reconnaissance, conducted from floating platforms situated beyond the 200-mile quarantine line, has revealed a pristine wilderness, stunning in its organic diversity. Virgin forests now rise where once stood huge cities and poisonous industrial complexes. Gone are the tamed fields of the continent's interior plains, replaced by grasslands of incomparable biological richness. Most significantly, a majority of the great coastal metropolises, including New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Miami, New Orleans, and Houston, have all but disappeared, subsumed by rising sea levels. Nature, as is its wont, has reclaimed the land, wiping away the leavings of the imperialistic power that once radiated from its shores. Powerful images, indeed, but hardly unexpected. It is at ground level that our most startling findings have occurred. Next slide. These mummified remains, one male, one female, were recovered 23 months ago in an arid basin at the foot of Southern California's San Jacinto Mountains. Their monstrous appearance is inarguable. Note the elongation of the bones, particularly those of the hands and feet, which have taken on a claw-like aspect. The softening of the facial support structure, creating an almost fetal blandness, devoid of personality. The massive jaws and radically altered dentition. Yet, surprisingly, genetic testing indicates that they are, in fact, human beings. A paramutational counterpart of our species, endowed with the physiological attributes of nature's most fearsome predators. Excavated at a depth of just under 2 meters, these remains were found in the midst of many others, suggesting a mass die-off of some kind, probably occurring at or near the end of the first century AV, the same time frame to which carbon dating has attributed the writing of the Book of Twelves. Are these the virals that our forebears warned us of? And if they are, how did these dramatic changes come about? To this, there appears to be an answer. Next slide.
On the left, we see the EU1 strain of the GC virus taken from the body of the so-called frozen man, a polar researcher who succumbed to the infection a millennium ago. This virus, we believe, was the primary biological agent of the Great Catastrophe, a microorganism of such robustness and lethality that it was able to kill its human host within hours and virtually wiped out the world's population in fewer than 18 months. I draw your attention now to the virus on the right, which was extracted from thymus tissue of one of the two corpses found in the Los Angeles basin. We now believe this to be a precursor to the EU1 strain. Whereas the virus on the left contains a considerable quantity of genetic material from an avian source, more specifically, Corvus corax, known as the common raven, the one on the right does not. In its stead, we find genetic material linking it to an altogether different species. Though our teams have yet to identify this organism's genetic author, it bears some resemblance to Rhinolophus philippinensis, or the large-eared horseshoe bat. We are calling this virus NA1. Or North America one. In other words, the Great Catastrophe was caused not by a single virus, but by two. One in North America, and a second, descendant strain that subsequently appeared elsewhere in the world. From this fact, researchers have built a tentative chronology of the epidemic. The virus first emerged in North America, infiltrating the human population from an unknown vector, though in all likelihood a species of bat. At some later point, the NA1 virus changed, acquiring avian DNA. This new second strain, far more aggressive and lethal, subsequently made its way from North America to the rest of the world. Why the EU1 strain failed to bring about the physical changes caused by NA1, we can only speculate. Perhaps, in some instances, it did. But by and large, the consensus of opinion is that it simply killed its victims too quickly. What does this mean for us? Put succinctly, the virals of the Book of Twelves are not fiction. They are not, as some have claimed, a mere literary device, a metaphor for the predatory rapaciousness of North American culture in the BV period. They existed. They were real. The Book of Twelves describes these beings as a manifestation of an almighty deity's displeasure with mankind. That is a matter for each of us to weigh in the privacy of his or her own conscience. So too is the story of the man known as Zero, and the 12 criminals who acted as the original vectors of infection. Speaking for myself, the jury is still out. But in the meantime, we know who and what the virals were. Ordinary men and women infected with the disease. But what of humanity? What of the story of Amy and her followers? I turn now to the matter of survivors. Next slide. As everyone here certainly knows, it has been an exciting year in the field. Very exciting indeed. Excavations of several newly discovered human settlements in the North American West, dating from the first century of the quarantine period, have begun to bear fruit. Much of this work is still in its infancy. Yet I think it's no overstatement to say that what we've uncovered in the last 12 months alone has signaled a truly radical reconceptualizing of the period. Our understanding of the early quarantine period has long presupposed that no human inhabitants remained in North America between the equatorial isthmus and the Hudson frontier line following the year zero. The disruption to the continent's biological and social infrastructures was believed to have been so complete as to render the continent incapable of supporting human life, let alone any kind of organized culture. We now know. And once again, the last year has been extraordinary, that this view of the quarantine period is incomplete. Indeed, there were survivors. Just how many, we may never know. But based on the findings of the last year, we now think it possible, indeed very likely, that they numbered in the tens of thousands, living in a number of communities throughout the Intermountain West and the Southern Plains. The size and configuration of these settlements varied considerably, from a mountaintop village housing just a few hundred inhabitants to a city-sized compound in the hills of central Texas. But all give evidence of human habitation well after the continent was thought to have been depopulated. These communities also share a number of distinctive traits, most significantly, a culture that was both classically survivalist and, paradoxically, deeply attentive to the social practice of being human. Within these protected enclaves, the men and women who survived the great catastrophe and generations of their descendants went about their lives, as men and women do. They married and had children. They formed governments and engaged in trade. They built schools and places of worship. They kept records of their experience. I am speaking, of course, about the documents known to everyone in this room, indeed to people throughout the settled territories as the Book of Sarah and the Book of Anti, and perhaps even sought contact with others like themselves beyond the walls of these isolated islands of humanity. Using the Book of Twelves as a roadmap, research teams on the ground have identified three such settlements, all named within those writings. These include Kerrville, Texas, Roswell, New Mexico, the site of what has been called the Roswell Massacre, and the community we know as First Colony in the San Jacinto Mountains of Southern California. May I have the next image, please? The photograph we see here provides an aerial view of the layout of the First Colony site, which might, for our purposes today, be considered a typical human settlement of the quarantine period. Situated on an arid plateau 2,000 meters above the Los Angeles coastal formation, and guarded to the west by a granite ridge rising an additional 1,500 meters, the settlement presents itself very like a walled medieval city, roughly 5 square kilometers, irregularly shaped, with high ramparts defining the outer perimeter. These steel and concrete fortifications, which stood 20 meters high, appear to have been constructed right around the time of the Great Catastrophe. This conforms to the Book of Twelves, which asserts that First Colony was constructed to house children evacuated from the eastern coastal city of Philadelphia. Beyond these fortifications, the terrain now presents a mixture of alpine forest and high desert chaparral, but soil samples taken both within and outside the walls indicate that the mountainside was decimated by fire as recently as 50 years ago, and during the first century of the quarantine period, the terrain was almost entirely denuded. The entire settlement seems to have been surrounded by banks of high-pressure sodium vapor lamps. These were powered, we believe, by a stack of proton exchange membrane fuel cells, connected by a buried cable to an array of wind-powered turbines, also dating from the pre-Q period, located 42 kilometers to the north in the San Gorgonio Pass. Seismic activity has substantially altered the northern slope of the mountain, and we have yet to locate the power trunk connecting First Colony to its primary energy source. But we hope this will happen in due course. Inside the walls, we find several discrete zones of human activity, arranged in a ring-like formation and leading to a central core. The outer ring, which has received the most extensive excavation, seems to have served as a staging platform for defense. From these areas, we have recovered a range of artifacts, including, at the lowest levels, a variety of conventional firearms of the pre-Q period, yielding at the upper levels to more homemade weaponry, such as knives, longbows, and crossbows. Though more primitive, these armaments were surprisingly sophisticated in their design and manufacture, with arrow points honed to a width of just 50 microns, sufficient, we believe, to pierce the crystalline silicate breastplate
of an infected human. Moving farther in, we find discrete regions for sanitation, agriculture, livestock, commerce, and housing. Structures in the eastern and northern quadrants of the interior appear also to have served as domiciles, perhaps for married couples or families. The exposed foundation we see near the center seems to have been some kind of school dating from the pre-Q period, but converted by the citizens of First Colony to perform a variety of civic functions. We believe that this building, the most substantial structure on the site, could have been employed as a final refuge in the event that the colony's outer defenses were penetrated. But in daily life, it seems to have served as a kind of communal nursery or hospital. On their own, these findings are remarkable enough. But there is more. The Book of Twelves speaks of First Colony as the place from which Amy and her fellows traveled east, eventually coming into contact with other survivors, including an armed force from Texas known as the Expeditionary. Is there any archaeological record to support these claims? I draw your attention now to the large open area at the center, and in particular to the object located on the northwest corner. May I have the next image? This object, which we are calling the First Colony Stone, sits adjacent to the settlement's central public space. The stone itself is an ordinary granitic boulder of the type found throughout the San Jacinto uplift, standing 3 meters high, with a basal radius of about 4 meters. Etched into its surface, we find three distinct groups of writings. The first group, by far the most extensive, begins with a date, 77 AV, followed by a list of what appears to be 206 names in four columns. As we can see, they are presented in family groups and include 17 different surnames. Though there is some debate on this point, the arrangement suggests that these individuals may have perished in a single event, perhaps one associated with the massive earthquake that struck California at about that time. Below this, we see a second group of three names, also legible: Ida Jackson, Elton West, and a person named as the Colonel, evidently a military leader of some stature. Beneath these markings, we see the single word, remembered. Our best guess is that these individuals may have perished in some kind of battle, perhaps one in which the fate of the colony itself was determined. It is the third grouping, however, that is the most provocative. As we can see, the etching is much less sophisticated, and exposure to the elements has rendered the names unreadable to the naked eye. Significantly, wear pattern analysis indicates that these markings date to about 350 AV, well after the settlement was abandoned. Again, there's some disagreement on this point, but prevailing opinion holds that these markings are, like the others, a memorial of some kind. Digital enhancement reveals names well known to all. May I have the final slide? These 12: Brad Walgast, Lacey Antoinette Cudotto, Anthony Carter, Alicia Donadio, Lucius Greer, Michael Fisher, Sarah Wilson, Hollis Wilson, Hightop Jones, Theo Jackson, Mausami Patal, Peter Jackson, beloved husband. And he shall be called the man of days for all the days he gave to humankind. Of Amy, the girl from nowhere, there is no mention. Perhaps we shall never learn who she was, if she existed at all. There is much we do not understand. We don't know who these people were. We don't know what role they may have played, if any, in the extinction of the paramutational race known as Virals. And we don't know what became of them, how they died. This gathering, I hope, will open the door to addressing some of these mysteries. But even more, what I wish is for all of us to come away with a deeper appreciation of the most fundamental questions that define us. History is more than data, more than facts, more than science and scholarship. These things are merely the means to a greater end. History is a story, the story of ourselves. Where do we come from? How have we survived? How can we avoid the mistakes of the past? Do we matter? And if we do, what is our proper place upon the earth? I shall put the question another way. Who are we? In a very real and pressing sense, the study of the North American quarantine period is far more than an academic investigation of the past. It is, and I think everyone in the room would echo this notion, a crucial step towards safeguarding the long-term health and survival of our species. This is all the more pressing now, as we contemplate humanity's long-awaited return to that feared and vacant continent. 91. For Logan Miles, age 56, professor of millennial studies and director of the Chancellor's Task Force on North American Research and Reclamation, it has been a good morning. A very good morning indeed. The conference is off to a roaring start. Hundreds of scholars are in attendance. Press interest is intense. Before he reaches the door of the ballroom, a wall of reporters surrounds him. What does it all mean, they want to know, these names on the stone? Were the 12 disciples of Amy real people? What will be the effect on North American reclamation? Are the first settlements going to be delayed? Patience, everyone, Logan says. Flashbulbs fire into his face. You know what I do, neither more nor less. Free of the crowd, he departs the building via a rear exit off the kitchens. It is a pleasant autumn morning, dry and blue-skied, with an easterly breeze coming off the harbor. High above, a pair of airships float serenely, accompanied by the vibrato buzzing of their massive propellers. The sight always brings his son to mind. Race, a pilot in the air service, has just been promoted to captain with a ship of his own. A great achievement, especially for a man so young. Logan pauses to take in the air before making his way around the corner of the building toward the campus's central quadrangle. The usual protesters linger by the steps, 40 or 50 of them holding their signs. North America equals death. Scripture is law. The quarantine must stand. Most are older. Country people, adherents to the old ways. Among them are perhaps a dozen Amalite clergy, as well as a scattering of disciples, women dressed in plain gray robes tied with a simple cord at the waist, their heads shorn in the manner of the Savior. They have been there for months, always showing up at precisely 8 a.m., as if clocking in for a job. At the start, Logan found them irritating, even a little disturbing. But as time went by, their presence acquired a quality of doomed listlessness, easily ignored. The walk to his office takes 10 minutes, and he is both pleased and surprised to find the building practically empty. Even the department secretary has flown the coop. He makes his way to his office on the second floor. In the past 3 years, he has become an infrequent visitor. Most of his work is now in the Capitol, and he sometimes doesn't set foot on campus for weeks at a stretch, not counting his visits to North America, which have devoured whole months. With its walls of bookshelves, enormous teakwood desk, a splurge to mark his promotion to department chair 15 years ago, and overall atmosphere of professorial seclusion, the room always reminds him of both how far he's come and the unlikely role that has been thrust upon him. He has reached a kind of pinnacle. Yet it is still true that from time to time he misses his old life, its quiet and routine. He is sorting through a file of papers, a tenure committee report, graduation forms requiring his signature, a caterer's bill, when he hears a knock and looks up to see a woman standing in the doorway, 30 or perhaps 35 and quite striking, with auburn hair, an intelligent face, and energetic hazel eyes. She wears a tailored suit of dark navy and high, somewhat tippy heels. A well-used leather satchel hangs from her shoulder. Logan senses that he has seen her before.
Professor Miles, she does not wait for permission to